I call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, January 23rd, 2023. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Klayman, Senator Vice Chair, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Dunbar, Senator Kaufman, and myself, Senator Giesel. Senator Bishop is excused today. So thank you to Carrie Kuppenreiter for recording our minutes today and helping us out in the Juno LAO is Talia Eames. Thank you for your help. Without you, our meeting would be impossible. I also want to welcome the folks here in the meeting room and the folks online that are watching this committee meeting. Please take a moment to be sure to silence your cell phones. Today we have one item on the agenda. We're going to hear from the Department of Natural Resources on Alaska's North Slope oil and gas resources. So today I will welcome our presenters. In person we have Mr. Derek Nottingham. He's the director of the Division of Oil and Gas. Mr. John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and Commissioner Designee John Boyle. On the phone, I see we have Mr. Sean Clifton, Policy and Program Specialist, Division of Oil and Gas, and Ms. Haley Payne, Deputy Director, Division of Oil and Gas. And that's about it. So, welcome to the folks here in the room. If you want to come forward, please identify yourself for the folks at home and for our recording secretary. As you change speakers, if you would identify yourself again, that just helps folks recognize who's speaking. So, welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Co-Chair. This is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, for the record. It's our pleasure to be in front of you today to talk about North Slope oil and gas activity. And before we kick it off to our technical expert, I'll just offer a few high-level comments. The first is there's reason for optimism when it comes to our North Slope activities. What we're seeing is a prodigious amount of infield work by our existing operators that are largely keeping our legacy assets, that's Prudhoe Bay, the Kuparuk River unit, and Alpine, at, you know, relatively stable production levels. So some of the steeper decline curves that we've seen of yesteryear have stabilized, and now we're seeing very flat production, which, again, for legacy fields that are nearing 50 years of age, is a significant, you know, outcome in and of itself, and indicative of the investments being made there and the work being done to bolster those fields. In addition to that, you know, we are seeing, of course, increased activity for some of our newer developments. You know, later in 2022, we saw Santos make its final investment decision for the Pikka project, which is located on state lands. You know, that project is expected to come online in 2026 and bring 80,000 barrels of production a day in. You know, that project, along with Willow, are two projects that are actually targeting the Nanuship formation, which is, you know, the geologic formation that is sparking a lot of interest in a number of companies doing exploration work on the North Slope. And so one of the things that we're seeing is in areas where, you know, there are Nanuship plays, you know, companies are you know, putting together plans of exploration and moving forward on evaluating that resource potential. So, you know, combined with the work that's being done at the legacy fields, you know, we just recently shared our production forecast in the Senate Finance Committee and just hours ago in the House Finance Committee. You know, we see production generally staying relatively stable for the next decade with, you know, opportunities for increase towards the end of that window as we see some of these new fields come online. And then I guess lastly, you know, one of the interesting opportunities that we're identifying here is that there's a demand and a need for companies to offset their carbon emissions. A number of major oil companies have announced goals to limit their scope 1 and 2 emissions. And, you know, a lot of them are looking for solutions, including, you know, carbon capture, utilization, and storage in underground reservoirs as one method to offset their carbon emissions. So we, you know, in addition to taking a look at our resources that are under the ground, you know, are also looking at the pore space that we have under the ground and our ability to actually store carbon so that companies that want to come up here and develop a new hydrocarbon project can do so and still obtain, you know, net zero emissions goals. So we see this as a really exciting opportunity for the state, and we're looking forward to talking about that. So with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Director Nottingham.
Commissioner-elect, could I ask a quick question, though? You brought up carbon sequestration or storage, right? What about using it for enhanced oil recovery? Is that possible on our slope?
Yeah, Chair Giesel, that is possible on the North Slope, and I have actually a petroleum reservoir engineer in the room as well that could probably speak to the actual physics and the mechanics of how that can work. But yes, there are, you know, companies on the North Slope, of course, have been injecting gas into reservoirs for decades for the purpose of enhanced oil recovery. So there are opportunities there with you know, carbon dioxide. I'll leave that to the experts in the room to explain how that works, but it is a possibility.
Thank you.
For the record, I'm Derek Nottingham. I'm the director of the Division of Oil and Gas. And just a little bit about me before we kind of get started. I've got about 24 years in the oil and gas industry. I've worked for several major oil companies, lastly BP before BP left the state. So I had about 12, 13 years of experience with BP. Before that, I worked for Chevron and Texaco. My basic background is in petroleum engineering. I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree in petroleum engineering. I also have a master's in business and professional engineering license as well. So that's a little bit about my bio. I've worked for the state for going on 2 years now. I started out with the state in the Department of Revenue, and I've transitioned over to the director of the Division of Oil and Gas. Oh, apologies. Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and I've been in this position for about a year now. Okay, so with that, if it's okay, Chair Giesel, we'll just kind of go right into the presentation. Before we kind of get past this title slide, I do want to kind of follow up on some of the commissioner's comments. You know, 2022 was an interesting year. We're kind of coming out of COVID and into a world where the term energy security is of utmost importance. And we saw the price of oil spike to like $120 a barrel in the summer, only to kind of see interest rates come up and the price of oil fall towards the last part of the year as we see some effects of economic slowdown and those kind of things. We also continue to see, and so these are some of the things that are just kind of framing some of the activity that we see on the North Slope and how those resources get played out over time. We also see the environmental, social, and governance, ESG kind of policies from the companies that work on the slope playing out and how those are starting to affect some of the activities as well. And as the commissioner mentioned, carbon capture is one of those solutions, a technology that can help our companies continue to develop the resources on the North Slope while meeting their ESG goals. But before I move on, one thing I wanted to do is make sure that it gets in the room that we have a great track record in the state of Alaska for producing oil in an environmentally friendly and safe way. We have great rocks, and we've had really good operators that have achieved world-class recovery in some of the fields that we've produced, like Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, Alpine, and we expect to continue to see more of that in the future. So with that, I'll just kind of go through to the next slide. Already kind of moved through the introduction, but we'll recap some of the North Slope resources and activity, and then do a bit of a project update on some of the major projects that folks are more familiar with. And then we're going to talk about three or four projects here that maybe folks aren't as familiar with, the methane hydrates test project, natural gas trucking and what's going on with that, Willow and Anwar updates. And then we'll go over some of the net zero goals that the companies have and how that's influencing them, and also what carbon capture utilization and storage may mean for the North Slope operation. Any questions before I move on?
I don't see any. That's a great agenda. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, so on this slide, the USGS estimates that North Slope has more oil than any other Arctic nations. We've already produced nearly 19 billion barrels of oil, and then we still have significant amounts of oil coming from those legacy fields that the commissioners already mentioned, plus recent large discoveries like we've mentioned, Willow and Pika. There still remains undiscovered oil resources estimated of 48 billion barrels on the North Slope. So if you combine those two numbers together, the 19 already produced plus the 48 billion barrels of oil yet to be discovered, that's a total resource base of nearly 70 billion barrels of oil. And that's not to mention the gas that is on the slope. We've discovered 50 trillion cubic feet, or TCF, as you see there. Much of that is in the Prudhoe Bay gas cap and in Point Thompson. Undiscovered conventional gas outside of those areas, 194 TCF is what's estimated. And then unconventional gas like methane hydrates and shale gas, it's estimated 125 TCF of those kind of resources. So the point is that Alaska's North Slope is a huge resource basin, as we all know. And as the commissioner alluded to, there has been increasing interest in the North Slope over the last several years, despite some of the, you know, impacts from COVID, some of the impacts from obtaining financing for Arctic investment. We've still seen a steady incline over the last several years in activity and interest. And that's driven a lot by the recent finds in Pika, Willow, the new Nanushuk formation and the Toorak formations are driving a lot of that renewed interest. And, you know, the new data over those areas suggests that there's enormous potential there. And then, like the commissioner mentioned, the legacy fields of Prudhoe and Kuparuk have done very well and mitigated the declines seen earlier on in the century and over the previous decade. We've seen that occur over the last, say, 5 to 6 years. Any questions on this slide before I move on?
I don't see any.
This next slide really kind of shows us where that 18.7 billion barrels of oil has come from. The units on here are in millions of barrels, and they're the cumulative amounts of oil that have been produced, let's say, over the last 45 plus years off of the North Slope. So I'll start with, and I'll really just highlight the four or five major units, starting with Prudhoe Bay of 13.9 billion barrels of oil, and continuing to go strong. The field continues to produce well over 200,000 barrels of oil while circulating around 8 BCF or billion cubic feet of gas per day. So it's a very large gas cycling operation to recover that oil. Lots of energy has to go into it. Lots of investment to maintain that operation. Within that gas, we mentioned CO2, a fairly large percentage of the gas is CO2, I want to say 10% or 11%. So there is, within the Prudhoe Bay gas cap, a significant amount of carbon dioxide that has been and can be used for enhanced oil recovery to answer your previous question, Chair Beasley.
Gotcha. Thank you.
In addition, Kuparuk River, 2.9 billion barrels almost, the Alpine or the Colville River unit, over 600 million barrels, Duck Island or Endicott, 526 million barrels, Milne Point, nearly 400 million barrels. Those are what I would consider world-class oil fields anywhere in the world. And we have them right here in our own backyard, several of them. And the smaller fields, I think any petroleum engineer would love to work on many of these smaller fields as well, because those numbers and the cumulative volumes that we've seen out of those are fairly comparable to some great oil fields elsewhere. So, any questions?
I don't see any. Thank you. While you're going to the next page, I just want to note that Representative McKay has joined us in the audience. Senator Kaufman, did you have a question?
Yes, ma'am. I was a little late to the game.
Yes.
I was just thinking. Sorry. Mm-hmm. To Director Nottingham through the chair. When folks think of mining, they think of crushing a bunch of rocks and getting a little bit of gold. But I think it's always instructive for people to understand the incredible volumes of material that you move to produce a barrel of oil. Could you just kind of give an idea of the ratio of, you know, water, et cetera, that is being produced and dealt with in order to produce that barrel, typically?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman. Yeah, for instance, I'll use Prudhoe Bay as an example because that is the field I'm most familiar with. In order to produce the 200 plus thousand barrels of oil coming from Prudhoe Bay, I mentioned we have to move about 8 BCF a day of gas. We also have to move about, I think it's nearly 2 million barrels of oil to get that 200,000 barrels. So the facilities required to handle that are enormous, and the effort, the energy that goes into it is substantial.
Good. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Director, through the chair, I feel like, as an Alaskan, I've heard the name Point Thompson many times. I'm sort of surprised there that number is as small as it is. Can you explain a little bit about why? I mean, it seemed to consume a lot of media space and a lot of energy, and yet do we expect it to produce much more in the future? Is it sort of just getting ramped up, or is there some reason that it's relatively small compared to the others?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Dunbar. Yeah, Point Thompson is a difficult field in that there was significant complexity in the operations and getting them started up. So in the mid 2010s, there were significant issues with, I believe it's compression equipment, and so lots of a lack of reliability. Exxon, the former operator, had corrected a lot of that, and Hilcorp taking over in the last year has corrected that. The field itself is probably on the order of 8,000 to 10,000 barrels of oil per day, so it's a significant oil producer somewhere else, but relative to a Prudhoe or a Kuparuk, it's not a huge oil producer today.
Okay. Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, is that sort of the steady state we expect, or do we think it will increase in the future?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, that's the steady state that we expect for now. There are projects that have been contemplated to increase that volume. However, in our latest production forecast, we're not forecasting that to occur anytime soon. So the field itself is limited on how much gas it can inject. Mm-hmm. And that gas injection, that amount of gas that it produces, it has to inject. So that volume is basically the yield. So that 8,000 to 10,000 barrels a day is the yield from that gas.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Mr. Crowther, it's predominantly a gas field with some gas liquids being produced or were to be produced, as I recall that original agreement. Is that true? Could you clarify that?
Yes, Senator or Chair Giesel, yes, it is considered a retrograde condensate gas field. So the in-situ fluids are gas, and as the gas is produced up the well bores, pressure drops, the temperature drops, and the liquids condense, and those are the liquids that we recover and produce, or that go down taps, and that remaining gas gets re-injected to maintain pressure.
Great, thank you. Are those liquids still being produced?
Senator Giesel, yeah, yes, they are.
Okay, thanks. Other questions, Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, thank you. Just on the Point Thompson question, can you just remind us what the settlement agreement regarding Point Thompson called for? What were the terms?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, my recollection is that the settlement agreement required that the field have a capability of producing 10,000 barrels of oil per day or condensate per day, and perhaps injection of 200 million cubic feet per day. Over the course of Point Thompson's life, say in the last 5 years, it has hit that 10,000 barrel per day mark for several months, but not on a consistent basis.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
So would that be deemed to be in compliance with the settlement agreement, or have there been periods of time where there's been non-compliance with the settlement agreement?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I can get back to you on that. My quick answer is yes, it is probably in compliance, and I'm not aware that it's been out of compliance.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, and then just the costs. What sort of field cost allowances have there been at Point Thompson?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I'll have to get back to you on that. I'm not as familiar with the field cost allowances.
Thank you.
Yeah, it would be good to get an update on what's happening at Point Thompson. That'd be great. Thank you. Any other questions at this point? Senator Wilikowski?
On this page, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Because just looking forward, I don't know, that looks like we're going to be getting off a little bit. But just could you give us an update on the road dispute between Conoco and Santos?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that is currently in litigation, and I probably will have to abstain from answering the question since I'm involved in it, I guess you'd say.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, for the record, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Just as a general matter, so the department made an administrative decision through the division that was appealed to the commissioner's office. There was a decision issued on that appeal recently. The parties have taken that final administrative action to court, so it's being reviewed by the court. The Department of Law would have to comment on any position of the state in that litigation. But as Derek said, it is concluded as it relates to the department's administrative activities.
Great. Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski?
A couple points on that. Number one, has that slowed down production at all or development at all in the field? That's number one. And number two, has the state taken a position to intervene in that matter, or does the state plan to intervene in that matter?
Yes, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, answers to both those questions. You know, I think responding to the first one too substantively probably goes to the restrictions on commenting on the ongoing litigation. I'll just note to the publicly available information, we did see an announcement of final investment decision by the project proponents of the PICA project earlier this past year now. And so that's the most recent public statement by those companies about their intentions for development of the field. The litigation has been filed against the state as a state action. So ConocoPhillips, the owner and operator of the Kuparuk River unit, has challenged the state's permit there. So we're a party to the litigation. And other parties may seek to join it or intervene in it pursuant to the judicial process and rules.
Further follow-up?
Different topic, if I could. Please. No one else has questions. Just on PICA, what's the status of the facility at PICA? Are they building their own facility to process the oil and gas there, or are they seeking facility sharing agreement at all?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, Santos is building their own facility to handle the oil production from PICA.
Yes, follow up.
And Willow also, their own facility for Willow as well, will be using the same one or a different one?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I'm not as familiar with Willow. The operator for Willow is Conoco. And we do have a slide coming up later in the presentation that may shed light on that.
Further questions? All right, seeing none. Thank you.
So if we move to the next slide, if that's okay?
Yes, that'd be great.
Yeah, this slide in particular, I don't want to read every number off of here, but just want to highlight maybe some of the key points from it. If you notice on the west side of the North Slope, ConocoPhillips has a large working interest, ownership interest in a lot of the units on the west side. With Beartooth, which is the Willow Project, Greater Moose's Tooth, the Colville River, which is the Alpine Field. Nestled in between there, you can see the Pica units and the Horseshoe and Quokka units that are recently formed that Santos is now the owner and operator of. In the midst here, you can kind of still see where you got the major fields, Kaparik, Milne Point, Prudhoe, with varied working interests. Kaparik is now the majority owner is ConocoPhillips. BP at some point had an interest, ExxonMobil as well, and as Chevron, but now Conoco is the major interest owner there. Whereas in Prudhoe Bay, if you'll notice, combined, Exxon, Mobil, and Conoco are 72% interest owner, and Hillcorp, the operator, is 26% interest owner. It's an interesting fact about how Prudhoe Bay is operated by a minority interest, working interest owner. The other thing to notice, at least in my observation from looking at how things are spread out across the North Slope, is that the Eastern North Slope operations are, in a large part, say, dominated by Hillcorp, whereas on the western side, there's Conoco is the major player. But what's also interesting is to the south, you're starting to see companies like Great Bear develop, Alkaid and Talitha, and some of the further south sort of non-traditional oil fields.
Question, Senator Wilikowski.
Does the Prudhoe Bay operating agreement require the consensus of all the operators before investment decisions are made, or is it a majority?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, my understanding is it requires all operating owners from the Prudhoe Bay unit.
Follow up.
Do you have the figures for how much has been invested in Prudhoe Bay in the last 3 years?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I don't have those numbers.
I saw a figure, I think it was 2021, where I think it was around $86 million was invested at Prudhoe Bay. Is that sound about right?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, that number does not sound familiar to me. It may be right, but I don't know.
Could I request that we get those numbers, Madam Chair?
Sure. Yes. Could we request that? And is DNR the agency that would have those numbers?
Chair Giesel, we can do our best to respond to that. The division of our Department of Revenue may be the best department to kind of ask for those numbers, though.
Okay. All right. We can ask Department of Revenue. Go ahead, Senator Wilikowski.
Has the department ever expressed concern over, as the owner of the resource, and with the obligation to make sure that we're getting the maximum benefit? Has the state ever expressed concern over the amount of investment at Prudhoe Bay in the last, say, 5 years?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, again for the record, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner. I don't want to characterize, you know, express concern, to points of getting you the information that you need. There's an annual review of plans of development and operation that go through the department. You know, in those discussions, there's regular updates about planned activities, both drilling activities, other investments, capital improvements in the facility. I would say, just as a general matter, to characterize what we've seen recently, the new operator, Hillcorp, has put a significant amount of effort and investment, perhaps sometime reallocation of operational expenses as opposed to capital investment into understanding and optimizing facilities and processing capacities in the field, things like water treatment, gas processing, gas handling, to increase essentially that flow cycle rate that the director referenced. And that's allowed for, I believe, in the last fiscal year prior to this one, a relatively flat or very slight increase out of the field, you know, which from the department's perspective as unit owner is a very significant accomplishment for such a legacy field. You know, and I don't want to speak to the details off the top of my head, but we do understand that there's the operator is looking at a drilling program for that field to continue infield drilling and make investments there to continue to maintain flat or even potentially provide for slight increases in the Prudhoe Bay unit and unit satellite production. So that's been an encouraging trend, but, you know, certainly new operator in the context of the COVID crisis was a dynamic time for them. So I hope that answers your question, but happy to continue to provide the updated information and work with Department of Revenue on it on capital expenditures.
Senator Glayman.
A little bit off, not exactly on the same line, but for example, when we look at the Willow Field and Point Thompson, the Prudhoe Bay Field, we get a lot. The state has a big revenue component coming from that field. How does that compare in Willow, and how does that compare in Point Thompson in terms of how much we're either getting in royalty oil or kind of our share? Because my sense, well, that's the question.
Senator Clayman, through the chair, my response to that is that a large percentage of the oil revenue that we obtain through North Slope operations is coming from Prudhoe Bay and Kaparik and the legacy fields and the Point Thompson, if you just consider how much it produces relative to some of those fields, then you kind of get a sense for how much that is. The exact numbers I have, I don't believe that we can provide that due to confidentiality.
Follow up, Senator Clayman.
I guess my question isn't so much how much money's coming in, but do those, I know Will is not online yet, but Point Thompson is, are we even in the same ownership position as to the resource on those two fields, for example, than we are on the legacy fields? I know the legacy fields are kind of classic. This is a state-owned resource, and we have royalty stuff, and we have other components. But for those newer fields, where do they fit on that spectrum without getting into the confidential? I mean, maybe how much they're bringing in is confidential, but the structure of that ownership shouldn't be confidential.
Senator Clayman, through the chair, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner for the record. So if we're speaking about kind of ownership and thus royalty allocation and interest, most state leases, of which Point Thompson are state leases on state-owned royalty or state-owned oil, that those royalty percentages vary from 12.5% to specifically 16 2/3%. And so the royalty ownership in Point Thompson, actually quite similar to Prudhoe Bay. The lease composition may set slightly different royalty rates for different leases. Right. And that contrasts to Greater Moose's Tooth, which is on federal land within the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. And so the royalty owner of that field and that oil is the federal government. Pursuant to federal law, the federal government is obligated to distribute a portion of that revenue, 50%, to the state of Alaska. And both pursuant to federal and state law, that's allocated to what's called the North Slope Community Impact Fund. And that program is managed to administer those revenues that come from the royalties to impacted communities across the North Slope. And so the royalty position is different, but development in the on federal land still has a under current law, a significant allocation of resources to the state of Alaska to the benefit of the local communities. And then, of course, things like production tax, property tax, corporate income tax still apply to those associated economic activities. But as you pointed out, the ownership position is different on the federal lands.
In addition, Willow will help reduce the tariff as it puts its oil into taps, which again is beneficial.
Senator Giesel, that's exactly correct. Any additional production on the slope, but especially something as significant as the Willow field, would significantly advantage all the value of every barrel on the slope and thus the state's royalty barrels for all produced fields. So a very significant additional benefit. Thank you for pointing that out, Chair.
And further, I'm not sure whether it's a question for the chair or for one of the folks here, but that's essentially because if Willow's in, then whatever percentage of the volume in the pipeline goes is Willow oil that gets essentially paid by the Willow operators, and that reduces the cost for all the other operators in the pipeline.
Yes, Senator Klayman, through the chair, again, John Crowther. To very oversimplify it, you can think of the TAPS project, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, having obviously a variable cost associated with each barrel costs a little bit more, but there's also a very significant fixed cost of running the pipeline. Whether you're shipping 200,000 or 500,000 or a million barrels, you have to pay that fixed cost. So the more barrels you can divide it over, the lower cost per barrel. And so that's the royalty boost that we would get from Willow Oil for state royalty barrels.
Good. Further questions on this page? All right. We can move on.
Chair Giesel. This next slide really illustrates the exploration drilling activity that has occurred in 2022 and is planned to occur in 2023. So what I'm going to do on this one is just move from west to east and just go through what we have on each one of these exploration projects. So furthest to the west, North Slope Energy announced plans to drill two wells in NPRA, known as the West Castle Prospect. And that will be targeting the Nanushuk. And those wells are planned or contemplated for 2023 or 2024. 88 Energy, as you see down towards the bottom, they drilled the Merlin II exploratory well last year. Basically reached the formation, were able to kind of get the data they needed, but found insufficient reservoir quality to warrant a well test. Basically, what that means is they felt like the rocks were not permeable enough to generate economic or commercial flow, and that well was plugged and abandoned. ConocoPhillips plans to drill the Bear 1 well in early 2023, so coming up here pretty soon, and that's targeting Brookian topsets. Brookian topsets is kind of the age of the rock where the Nanushuk and Toorak formation and several other potential reservoir targets are. So they're targeting that this year as well. Great Bear Pantheon, as you can see, they've been very active kind of in the south near the Hall Road. I'll start at the top. They completed the Theta West 1 well in April of 2022. Targeting the lower basin floor fan in the Talitha A well, and they had a successful flow test from that interval, found oil, light hydrocarbons in liquid form. Great Bear Pantheon also re-entered the Talitha A well that was drilled several years ago, and they were able to test that well and also get some successful flow rates from this lower basin floor fan and what they call the slope fan intervals. And they plan to go and drill the Talitha B exploration well, targeting that Brookian formation. They also completed the Alkaid 2 well in October of 2022. This particular well is a long horizontal hydraulically fractured well, and they're in progress of performing an extended flow test to test its commerciality. What they've reported is liquid hydrocarbon flow rates above 500 barrels per day, and they also plan to drill the Alkaid 3 well, pending the results from the Alkaid 2 well. And then 88 Energy to the south, they've applied for the Tulik River unit. They have executed a drilling contract to drill the Hickory 1 exploration well early this year, which will penetrate six reservoir targets, including that Brookings section and the Kaparik formation, to a depth of 12,500 feet, and they also plan on flow testing as well. And in addition to this, you know, I mentioned that we are also we formed the Horseshoe and Quokka units, as and those particular units also have commitments for further exploration as well.
Good. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Director, through the chair, what I can't tell from this slide is sort of the historical context. Is so you've highlighted sort of, you know, about almost a dozen things here, or 10. Is this a lot, a little? How does this compare to the last 5 years, the last 10 years in terms of exploratory drilling?
Chair Dunbar through the, Senator Dunbar through the chair. That is a great question. I have the sense that it's a little bit more. It's a bit of an increase. But I think it'd be worth us kind of going back and looking over time to see if that's true or not. It does seem to me like there's a bit more activity.
Madam Chair, can I ask a quick follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Director, through the chair, when you say an uptick, do you mean relative just to the last couple years, or, you know, presumably there was a heyday that was much higher than this? Sort of what's your time frame when you talk about a little uptick?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I would say within the last 5 years is kind of the time frame.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Director Nottingham, what might be helpful for the committee, we have three new members that have not served on resources before, and you're talking about the Brookian, the Kaparik Formation, the Nanushik. Could you provide us with that diagram that shows those different levels of these various formations? It's helpful, I think, to get a perspective.
Chair Giesel, we would be glad to do that.
That'd be great. Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. I remember, I think you were here, Senator, probably 11 or 12 years ago, Great Bear came in, gave a series of presentations, talked about like billions of barrels of recoverable oil on the North Slope. And obviously that hasn't happened, but I'm just curious if you can talk a little bit about, they're still drilling, and so they still must have some sense that there's something out there. Have they shifted their strategy? I remember they were drilling into several different layers. Can you just talk about the progression of what's happened with Great Bear?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, my sense of the progression with Great Bear is that they are definitely learning as they drill these wells where the formations that are likely to produce are, and they're making those adjustments on the I don't want to say on the fly, but as they get more information. So what was, you know, once dreamed up of as a plan back in, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, new information has come in, and this is very, very typical as oil companies, you know, gather geologic information and engineering information, as they have to kind of reassess and adjust. And that's my sense of what's happening with Great Bear.
Further questions? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, first a comment. I just want to say of exploration folks didn't stay optimistic, it would be hard to get out of bed in the morning. That's almost the emotional fuel that's required to keep on plugging away, literally sometimes. So to Mr. Nottingham, I wanted to chat about hydrates a little bit. I think that's pretty interesting. And so for the, you know, you have the subsea hydrates. There's been work on that, but for permafrost hydrates, is that a new thing? Is that leading edge?
Senator Kaufman, through the chair, yes, I would say that hydrates work has been going on in terms of trying to understand its behavior for quite a while. But and I didn't mention the blurb up there at the top that we do have this international hydrates test project ongoing on the slope, and you can kind of see up there it's in the western part of Prudhoe Bay, and we actually have a slide coming up on that. So I in general, the answer to your question is yes. I mean, this is it's new, it's different, and I think this slide will kind of allude to that when we get to it. I think it's a
We'll follow up when we get to the slide. Okay. We're about halfway through the meeting time now, so if you wouldn't mind waiting till we get to the slide, it's a couple more. I'll let you proceed to the next slide.
This slide is a status update of some of the key future projects on the North Slope. We've talked a bit about Pika and Willow. So Pika, just to kind of give a status, project FID or final investment decision was approved in August of 2022. And so they're going to start drilling this summer, and they're projecting first oil in 2026. Peak design capacity for phase one is 80,000 barrels of oil per day. Willow, we're awaiting the Bureau of Land Management Record of Decision, the ROD, on the supplemental environmental impact statement. So Conoco cannot move forward with final investment decision until that decision is out. And after final investment decision is out, if the environmental impact statement if the project is approved, it'll be 6 years before we see first production. That peak rate is 180,000 barrels of oil per day. And then some of the other projects below here, these are more infield kind of development projects. They're not as big, but they're definitely substantial in terms of, one, the investment, the cost to do them, but also the production that they can bring online. So CRU, Narwhal CD8, that refers to the Colville River unit. Narwhal is what is the reservoir, and CD8 is what is the pad. And so that's a project that's been tested already. It's produced at 1,600 barrels a day. The full project is up to 12 wells, requiring a new pad, or actually 20 to 40 wells, requiring a new pad, and that's starting in 2028. Sustained production from CD8 could commence then. As all of the stakeholder alignment, permitting, internal studies, those kind of things kind of come together, and that project could be 32,000 barrels of oil per day. The Milne Point unit, or MPU Raven pad, that's also sometimes called the RPAD development. That's a development that's very similar to what Hillcorp implemented with the 2018 project Loose Pad. So Hillcorp has decided that they're going to go forward with that. And they've applied to for approval to construct a new drilling and production pad, and we estimate around 10,000 barrels of oil per day for that particular project. The Kuparuk River unit, Nunatoraq, that is a rotary drilling planned, and actually last year with injector producer pairs for the Toroq Reservoir. And that will appraise and inform future developments with peak rates up to about 25,000 barrels of oil per day. So the point in this slide is there's a lot of news and excitement around Pika and Willow, but there's also some of these smaller, less glamorous projects that are ongoing that really help to stabilize that decline rate that we're seeing over time.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Director, through the chair, I know this is a difficult question to answer, but sort of very simplistic terms, or as general as you can be, as a percentage, about how much does the state earn on a barrel of oil that comes out of the legacy fields? And then how much do we earn on a barrel that comes out of Pica or out of Willow? Are those, and are they the same?
Senator Dunbar.
I'm sorry, can I clarify that, Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
And I'm general royalty plus tax plus anything else, not, yeah.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, it is a difficult question because it does depend on a large degree on what the oil price is and what oil price assumption that you put into that calculation. I think that the Department of Revenue does this analysis, and they may provide some of that in future presentations, maybe not to this particular committee, but they probably are the better department to ask that question.
If I step in just real quick, Senator Dunbar, for the chair. So there is one key difference in particular, and one is most legacy fields are at a royalty rate of around 12.5%, whereas some of these newer projects like Pica, which are on state land, which are issued pursuant to our new form leases, pay the 16 2/3 royalty. So just sort of offhand, it just gives you a little flavor of some of the difference between legacy production and new production with new fields on state land.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Kawasaki, you had your hand up.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. I have the revenue source book, and I'm just looking over some of the official forecast. It's got in Chapter 6, it's got a low case, official forecast, and a high case. And I don't see how the numbers really track quite the same, but I just sort of had a question on the peak capacity, in particular Willow. We're talking about 80,000 barrels per day under Phase 1. Would you anticipate a peak? When would you anticipate a peak, I guess, if first oil is anticipated in 2026? Is it one of those, you know, like you see the North Slope curves that are really high, 2 million barrels per day, and then all of a sudden drop? Or is it something that's something different than that?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, this is Commissioner Designee John Boyle for the record. So what we'd expect to see with Pica, for instance, is that, you know, production would actually start at that 80,000 barrel a day level, and then they would be able to maintain that level of production for some years before then you'd actually start to see that natural decline. And of course, on some of these fields, they're designing the facilities, you know, based on you know, what kind of capacity they see coming through. So, you know, with Pica, Phase 1 is designed at 80,000 barrels a day, but then if we look at their plans that they have publicly announced for Phase 2, for instance, then they forecast a ratchet up to 120,000 barrels a day when those additional drill pads are brought online. So, you know, of course, what the future production profile looks like is heavily dependent on, you know, whether the companies actually go through with making the investments as they've described, and two, also, you know, will the rocks or will the reservoir actually respond and produce the way that, you know, the geologists are hoping that they will. But generally, you know, these fields are still, you know, what we consider conventional. So they're not quite like what you may have heard of some of the shale plays in the lower 48 in Texas or North Dakota, where you might get a brief spike up and then a pretty significant decline in a relatively short period of time. You know, these fields can actually maintain a fairly consistent level of production for some time before they, you know, start to trail off.
Follow up, Senator Kawasaki? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just on that question, are all of these projects included in the DNR baseline production forecast?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, yes, they are.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski?
So when the Willow 180,000, what year does that kick in the production forecast?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, for the record, this is John Crow, the deputy commissioner. So when you look at the DNR's production forecast in a kind of simplified manner, these projects are in there, but they're smooth according to their likelihood over time, likelihood of coming in on schedule or at volume. And so, you know, not a department criticism or perspective on a project like Willow, but because it's further out, it has more smoothing, so to speak, in layman's terms, speaking as a layman here, in its where it shows up in that forecast. So we don't pick a year and put 180,000 barrels in it. We kind of say it's likely to come on in 2028 or 2029, could be 2030. So we'll kind of risk it and allocate it. And that similar methodology is applied to all these projects based on expert assessments within the division and other folks about how to forecast them and include them in forecast. But a project like PICA that has a final investment decision and has indicia of progress, you know, different contracting and things underway, you'll see it kind of show up as more of a peak in the forecast, but it is similarly still smooth. But, you know, we might expect in a year or two, if we see initial construction activities proceeding for PICA on time, that it will show up as a more discrete increase in our forecast and be less smooth. And similarly with Willow, if we did receive, as we believe the federal government is obligated to do, a positive final environmental impact statement and record of decision in the near future, and the company takes final investment decision, there'd be less risk weighting, so to speak, in how Willow would be portrayed in the department's forecast.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
I'm just curious. So, like Willow went, so you say you're saying first oil expected 6 years after FID. So when can we expect 180,000 barrels? I guess that's my question. When have you modeled that into the forecast?
Taking an attempt to answer, and of course, if the commissioner director want to supplement, so John Crowther, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we have a slide we can share with the committee that shows the under-evaluation projects and how we, in the base case forecast, they contribute. And you'll see in the years 2029, 2030, it's over 200,000 barrels of oil of additional production. That's not exclusive to Willow, but we can say in the aggregate, project like Willow is contributing to that in a significant way in those out years. And so, you know, the department's hope is that the appropriate federal actions and decisions will be taken, and the, you know, in a sense you could say a company like ConocoPhillips, without speaking too specifically, has a significant record of developing major projects and the capacity to do so. So, you know, their public-facing statements about their timeline and expectations would be a very reliable indicator of a reasonable base case for timeline and volume.
Follow-up.
And I know the department every few years tries to tweak the way they calculate the production forecast. Has the department changed their methodology at all in the last few years or in the last year or two?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, there were some minor tweaks this year, but nothing I would consider major.
Well, can I? What those tweaks were?
They were an adjustment to reconcile the current year production with what the current year production forecast with what DOR was forecasting. So historically, there had been a bit of a difference between what DOR would say versus what we would say, and it had to do with basically some of the timing on when the forecast was started. And then I believe there were also some adjustments to current year, currently producing fields, pools, that may have incorporated some amount of development drilling in the past. And what we've done is we've separated that out to ensure that our currently producing base forecast does not have any amount of development drilling. So there's basically some minor adjustments to correct some near-term flaws in the forecast.
Follow up?
So based on the methodology change, how much did that increase or decrease production, the production forecast in, say, the next 5 years?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I would say it's zero. It's just a kind of a shuffling of barrels from one category to another.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Great. Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you. And you know, just to understand this a little bit better, can I ask the department? So I'm just looking at the official forecast from the DNR revenue source or DOR revenue source book, and it has your production forecasts and your modeling in here. You know, when you look at it, it says that there's 500,000 barrels of oil produced in 2022, and it looks like a flat line for 6 years on the official forecast. So are you saying that even if PICA is added in 2026 fiscal year immediately goes to 80,000 barrels per day, it means that 80,000 barrels per day have dropped from the other ANS petroleum production forecast then? And so it's basically just replacing exactly where we're at today.
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, it probably isn't quite that simple. That is a simplistic, sort of a simple model. Not that we're being simplistic, but it is a simple way of thinking about it. What's happening over time is the existing fields, the existing production is on decline. And there are activities in the near term that are being done, like development drilling and some of these smaller projects that may come on sooner, that are replacing that decline, as well as when PICA comes online, that also is kind of filling that gap to replace the decline. And then I think it's not a significant bump towards the middle part of the century, 2027-ish, where there is an increase in production that can be associated with the risk profile kind of smoothed out of PICA coming online.
Senator Klayman.
For both PICA and Willow, what's the timeline that you're using internally in terms of when production begins?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, from the production forecasting standpoint, we reference what the operator, the company has said, and then through the process of doing that production forecast, a lot of our technical experts, I believe it's 24 folks, get together and they assess things like when that start date will actually take place, and they risk weight it. Some folks have a very optimistic opinion about when PICA might happen versus some folks may be a little bit more pessimistic. And that risk weighting, I don't know that there's an actual official number that comes out and says PICA will start on this date, but it does kind of generate a smooth kind of production profile showing an increase getting into the late 2020s.
Follow up, Senator Klayman.
For at least for purposes of today, what's your understanding when we would see the first production from PICA coming into the pipeline, and what is the current date in your mind that we would see the first oil from Willow coming into the pipeline?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, if I was in that room and I was voting, it would be 2026 for PICA and 2029 for Willow.
Thank you.
All right. We have five slides left and about 25 minutes. So this is a great conversation.
So the next slide is kind of a summary on the methane hydrates test project. So we were mentioning that this is actually ongoing. It's on the western part of Prudhoe Bay. So Japan is really interested in hydrates. They would love to have domestic energy security. So JOGMEC, or the Japanese Organization for Metals and Energy Security, and the U.S. Department of Energy have funded this program. Basically, what they're looking to do is determine the long-term production viability of methane hydrate reservoir. They're doing this in combination with ASRC Energy Services, or AES, and this is actually occurring on the 07-11-12 pad on, like I mentioned, the west side of Prudhoe. Their objectives are to drill two production test wells and a monitoring well. They're in the middle of that right now. They plan on starting the production test this spring, and that production test should occur from the spring of this year to December of 2024. As I mentioned, they're in the middle of that. They've already drilled the geologic data well and the production test well one, and they're currently on test well two. The chart on the left-hand side there at the bottom references a USGS study that was performed that described the hydrate potential on the North Slope as containing undiscovered resources on a mean basis of about 54 TCF of gas.
Very good. Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Director, again, through the chair. Sort of a similar question to what I had earlier. Can you give us some context of what does that number mean? You know, how big is that relative to the resource, to other places? How much revenue could the state get from that resource if it were to pan out? And also, similar to my colleague's questions, so they're doing these test wells. When would you estimate this might actually be able to be sold to the market? When can we actually expect to see this flowing?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, it's a great question. I'll attempt to answer the last question first. So this is kind of a one-of-a-kind project. There aren't many of these production tests going on out there. So testing methane, the producibility, commerciality of methane hydrates is we're just kind of starting on this journey. One of the things to factor into how commercial methane hydrates from the North Slope are is to factor in the amount of conventional resource that already exists there. So you asked for a comparative, a relative reference. So the known gas in the Prudhoe Bay gas cap, Point Thompson, is generally in the vicinity of 40 to 50 TCF, somewhere in there. So what we're talking about here in mean resources is about that order of magnitude. The reality is that gas, that known gas, conventional gas, is much easier to produce and would supply a substantial, would have a substantial life prior to methane hydrates probably becoming economic here. Where it is important is in the Japanese and Asian market, where they are in pursuit of a domestic supply for energy. And so this project is working really in conjunction with JOGMEC, DOE, to really kind of help them understand this resource. But in the future, it would be probably pretty far down into the future. I believe that this gas would have a similar royalty rate as our normal North Slope gas.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about methane hydrates. Is this something that can be shipped on taps, or is this something that you need to ship through the gas line that might get built one day?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So a methane hydrate is methane that basically is in like an ice-like form. It forms in the presence. You have to have like the presence of water, low temperature and pressure for it to form. So there's only certain regimes that you can actually have these methane hydrates. When you produce it, it produces out theoretically just like natural gas would, probably with a lot of water coming along with it, so you have to separate the water out. But that gas could be shipped down a gas line, for instance. It's probably not something that you can ship down taps.
Good. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, to Mr. Nottingham. So I'm just trying to picture this. So if the Japanese are interested in it, but they don't have hydrates stored in the same way that we do uniquely on the slope, the suboceanic hydrates offshore for them, as it is for us on the eastern seaboard, many other areas where it's even seen as a risk. So is this technology transferable to what they would be doing?
Senator Kaufman, through the chair, I believe it is, certain aspects of it for sure. The production methodology and whether that is going to work, I think, would be transferable. There's obviously, in a deep water environment, many more more factors that would have to be considered to make a project like that commercial. However, the North Slope is a great grounds for testing these things, at least, you know, some type of proof of concept to see if the production methodology is actually viable.
Okay. Senator Kaufman, through the chair, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, for the record. Just to supplement that a little bit, the state of Alaska is one of the few places in the world, as we understand it, that has
subsurface surface accumulations of hydrates coextensive with existing infrastructure for oil and gas operations. And so we've, from the state's interest, we view us are kind of uniquely positioned to be the first movers and participants in a, were there to be large-scale commercial developments of hydrates, we would be kind of the place to do it. Many other places that have other kinds of deposits might hope to do it, but we would hope to be first in the game, hence facilitating the research.
Follow-up?
Good. Follow-up?
I just wanted to comment. So it's really a case where we're leveraging our unique circumstances to gain technological advantage in this area. And so at this point, it's an R&D type project.
Through the chair, yes, sir, that's correct.
Great, thank you.
Thanks. Next slide.
This next slide really kind of goes into some new opportunities that we're seeing on the slope in terms of trucking natural gas to market. So you may have seen recently that there's an agreement between Hillcorp North Slope and the Interior Gas Utility. So Hillcorp and its subsidiary Harvest have agreed to produce LNG from Prudhoe Bay Gas. That facility, roughly 150,000 gallons of LNG per day, is planned to be built in or by October 2024, so online by then. They've got a 20-year contract with opportunity to increase that term and capacity with the Interior Gas Utility. And they plan on trucking that LNG from Dead Horse to Fairbanks. The big benefit here is that supplementing Interior gas from the North Slope also alleviates some of the pressure for gas supply in the Cook Inlet.
Thanks. And we'll be having GVA, the utility there, as well as the Hillcorp Harvest Group coming to present on this topic in the future. So we'll go ahead and press on. The Willow Project update is, I believe, next.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Giesel. So on Willow, as we've mentioned, we're in the kind of the final stretch here, I think, on the supplemental environmental impact study or statement. Sorry, the comment period for that draft final supplemental environmental impact statement closed August 29th, 2022. We received a preliminary final this month, and that's being reviewed by cooperating agencies, including the state of Alaska. Public review for that is planned to be March and April of this year, and final record of decision June, July of 2023. Then subsequent to that, we expect that we'll get permits to the state pipelines coordinator, state pipeline coordinator section, and begin pre-application discussions for the pipelines. Construction, there has been some early staging and construction works this winter, and expect that to continue into 2024. And as we've mentioned, expected peak production, 180,000 barrels of oil, 600 million barrels of oil estimated total. And there is a royalty estimate in here of 8 to 7 billion barrels of royalty and production tax payments to the state.
Great. Questions? Senator Dunbar.
Just a very quick one, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, Mr. Director, you just said production tax, but on the slide it says property tax.
Oh.
Are those... Are we going to get production tax from these things?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, all oil production on the North Slope is subject to both the severance tax and property tax for the infrastructure.
Okay. So we, all right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Moving on, ANWR update.
Yeah, this slide shows the ANWR leases that were up for lease sale several years ago. And the blue shading there shows the leases that remain suspended that ADA has. And that is pending completion of another supplemental environmental impact statement. The other two lessees have relinquished their leases, so Ada's are the only one remaining. This one is under lease suspension litigation, and that's in briefing cross motions for summary judgment. Those were filed, plaintiffs and state's opening briefs were filed in December. The Bureau of Land Management's response is expected early February, and the briefing should conclude in mid to late March. The leasing program litigation remains stayed pending completion of the SEIS. And next status report is due in April of this year.
Senator Klayman.
Is that only with respect now to what I will call the ADA leases because the other two leases were relinquished?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, yes, the other two leases have been relinquished, so the remaining leases in the coastal plain are the ADA leases.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be for another department too, but why, Mr. Director, through the chair, why in your estimation those two other entities relinquish their leases?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I really don't have a good idea why that would be. It is a difficult area, and the action by the federal government probably has something to do with that. I'll let Commissioner Crowther or Commissioner Boyle speak to that.
Senator Will, or excuse me, Senator Dunbar, through the chair, just to speak to that a little bit. You know, to the degree those companies have stated a position that's, you know, the most authoritative sense for the basis of their decisions. Just for context and background, it's quite clear the current federal administration, the president during his campaign, mentioned an intent to limit or remove the ability to develop the coastal plain and to change the existing federal law, which mandates the leasing and development in the coastal plain. And so when administration began, there were several discrete actions, including the lease suspension, including the initiation of a supplemental EIS to put additional restrictions on the development program that all indicated a disfavor, in addition to legislative initiatives to outright repeal and change the existing federal law that requires the development. So all of those factors any company may consider to be a challenge to a project or a plan, and unfortunately to impede the recovery of these resources for the state and for the benefit of the U.S.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Next slide is greenhouse gas.
Chair Giesel, I'm not going to read every word on this slide. It is a very busy slide, but I think what we're illustrating here is the net zero greenhouse gas initiatives of the North Slope companies. They the multinational companies, they all seem to have them. They're all shooting towards a net zero emissions by somewhere in the mid part of this century, 2040, 2050. There's different aspects you can kind of see on this slide, whether it's scope one or scope two or even scope three. So they all have kind of differing methods and paths to get there, but they're all operating under this this assumption to get to net zero, sort of in that mid-century time frame. And Hillcorp, being privately owned company, does not have a particular path saying or a goal saying they will be net zero by X date. But what they have said about this, and I think it's important to know what they have said, is that they've got to operate to the same high standards as everybody else, because basically, they might be private, but they have capital providers, they have partners, they have lots of other people involved in business with them. So they feel the same pressures to get their emissions down as well. So that's what this slide is really speaking to. And so
it's an interesting slide. Thanks for including it.
You're welcome. And are there any questions before we move on to the last slide here?
Co-chair Giesel, if it's okay, for the record, Deputy Commissioner Crowther. Just to add a little bit of more context for this slide, and I think the director summed it up very well, but, you know, in the context of, you know, the governor spoken about carbon management, carbon offsets, and other opportunities in the state and launching the state into that,
opportunity space. One of the reasons we wanted to share this slide is that essentially these companies and with these stated missions are partners and or customers of state programs. And so, you know, these companies to achieve these goals are either going to be purchasing offsets somewhere in the world to offset their emissions or undertaking carbon capture projects somewhere in the world to offset their emissions. And we figure that Alaska as a place to develop hydrocarbons, to develop oil and gas resources, is also a place to offset them to the greatest degree possible. So that we view it really as a synergy and almost a potentiation for investments and activity by all these companies in Alaska if we are also able to offer the kind of carbon management products that they've stated they're getting into the business of. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. All right. Last slide is geologic carbon storage.
Yeah, so with that, this kind of the previous slide leads right into this. So as Deputy Commissioner Crowther mentioned, Alaska, we want to kind of play a part in facilitating the net zero goals of companies in whatever way we can. We have a vast resource. This slide really only speaks to the geologic carbon storage, not necessarily carbon offsets, but just what we call carbon capture, utilization, and storage, or you'll hear CCUS. And the maps here on the bottom left really show where we see high potential for coal seam or unmineable coal injection storage potential there. There's also storage capacity in our depleted oil and gas fields. Saline aquifers are also a potential storage site or underground storage site for carbon in the future. So, and then we did mention earlier about tertiary recovery or CO2 flooding. That is also a potential on the North Slope and in the Cook Inlet for future use of CO2 for enhanced oil recovery. We have a lot of subsurface data that's already available to the public. This slide is actually going to be a poster at NAEP, so it's North American Production Exposition. One of the big draws for Alaska is that we have large contiguous blocks of state land ownership that's not confused, I guess you'd say, complicated with multiple ownership. And so that is that could be a potential draw for companies to want to inject and bring their carbon here as opposed to somewhere else in the lower 48 where those private ownerships may confuse the situation, I guess you'd say. So we do have a carbon storage bill that addresses the state leasing regime, underground injection control or injection well permitting, pore space access, and long-term liability.
Very good. So we'll be hearing more, yes, as the bill comes forward.
Absolutely.
Great. Any questions at this time on this slide? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Director Nottingham, is that on the slope, you're not anticipating commercial storage from outside sources. That's more of the what's produced through production and separation, what, 12% of volume? Is that pretty much what you see there?
Senator Kaufman, through the chair, that's what you can kind of see in the near future. But, we wouldn't want to, for instance, exclude any opportunity to import CO2 into the slope at some point in the future. So the legislation will probably try to encompass that and be very broad in its application, I should say.
Thank you. Makes sense.
Very good. Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question back to the Fairbanks trucking proposals, if you know these answers. The facilities are supposed to produce 150 gallons per day. I just had a question about enhanced oil recovery and the natural gas offtake of those facilities, how it was decided upon that amount, and whether it was constrained due to the enhanced oil recovery.
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, the 150,000 barrels or gallons of NGLs, when it's translated back to how much gas is that per year, I want to say the range, or it starts off at about a BCF of gas, or 1 billion cubic feet of gas per year, to 4, 5 billion cubic feet of gas per year over time as the facility expands. For context, the amount of gas that we're injecting in Prudhoe Bay to provide pressure support, basically cycling the gas around, is about 8.5 BCF per day. So it, in a relative sense, it's a pretty small volume. These kind of small sales of gas have historically occurred over time. It is something that the Prudhoe owners are cognizant of, but it likely has very little effect on the actual recovery of the reservoir.
Super. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the presentation, the overview. We do have several questions we'll be submitting either to you or to the Department of Revenue. So great conversation on those topics. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
So that concludes our meeting today. Our next hearing is on Wednesday, January 25th at 3:30. We'll be hearing from the Idaho National Lab introducing the Frontiers Collaboration. So this will be on nuclear energy on Wednesday. So at this time, this meeting is adjourned. Let the record reflect that the time is 4:56 p.m.